KDHX, St. Louis Community Radio. My name is Jean Ponzi, and it's my pleasure and privilege to be your host every Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m. for an hour of conversation about green stuff, of which there is never a lack in the subject matter department. Tonight, June 17th, 2008, most of this show is going to be devoted to one topic. That's unusual on this program, Earthworms. The last few weeks, we've been squeezing in two, three, four topics because there have been so many things going on in the St. Louis metropolitan area. But tonight, we're going to be talking about mosquitoes. Yes, indeed. Those little flying bloodsuckers that we have around our yards and in our parks that are an important part of natural systems and food chains, and we'll find out why, and also can pose an extreme hazard to humans. And part of tonight's subject matter will be letting you know how to protect yourself from some of those hazards. So, the worms bow to mosquitoes on this edition of Earthworms Environmental Talk on KDHX, St. Louis Community Radio. Nothing like a good polka to set the tune on any given edition of an environmental talk show. That happened to be a Parisian polka. Yes, indeed. In France, they kiss on Main Street, and they polka, too. On the line with us, my guest, Dr. Richard Lampman, who is an entomologist. He is a specialist in bugs with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, Illinois Natural History Survey. Richard Lampman, welcome to Earthworms and KDHX. It's kind of a rare pleasure that I get to talk to an expert from the Illinois side of our listening area. This is kind of a Missouri-centric show, even though we have a bi-state listening audience. So thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, I think we have more mosquito experts than you guys do.
You do, because I don't know of any. I found out about you from an article in the, the Collinsville Journal, one of the suburban journals, not too long ago. St. Clair County Journal, that was it. So, as an entomologist, is there a name for your specialty focusing on mosquitoes?
Well, I consider myself a medical entomologist, and so what I do is I look at pathogens that are transmitted by arthropods, insects, and ticks.
Uh-huh.
And my specialty right now is more or less the behavior and biology of Culex mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
Which are common mosquitoes that are transmit West Nile virus.
I thought Culex was a mosquito genus name, and then there were species that were specific
right.
from that.
Culex is a genus name, and then we think that there are several Culex species
uh-huh.
that are involved with the transmission of West Nile virus.
Uh-huh.
Early in the season, we think it's a Culex restuans, which is a native mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
We think it's one of the ones that starts the cycles going very early and keeps it very local.
Mm-hmm.
And as the season progresses and the temperatures warm up, another species come along, the northern house mosquito, which is the Culex pipiens.
Uh-huh.
And if we look at the transmission of West Nile virus, the number of pools of mosquitoes that are positive, the number of cases of horses and humans, it parallels the increase in Culex pipiens abundance.
Uh-huh.
So what we think would happen then is that this mosquito is increasing, and it's a bird feeder primarily, but it has a little bit of mammal feeding in it.
Hmm.
And so that little bit of mammal feeding bridges the transmission cycle from the bird-mosquito-bird cycle over to mammals.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you the truth. It is prevention of West Nile virus that prompted this topical focus on this show, because it is a disease that people really do not want to get, even though not very many people get it seriously. And so much of preventing that disease rests with individuals, neighborhoods, homeowners, et cetera. It's something that public health officials really can't do a lot about, yeah?
One of the big things is that when you have mosquito management in an area, it can only do but so much, because they normally don't go into your backyards and around your house.
Yeah.
That is where you have the greatest number of breeding sources, the larval habitats for the mosquitoes. And they're right outside your house, so the association there, the exposure rate is generally high.
Right. And so when public health agencies come through with spraying trucks, for example, aerial spraying trucks, what does that do exactly?
Well, typically you use adulticide, if they're doing an aerial for an adulticide, it's usually using a chemical in a very low volume. Typically, it's what they call ultra-low volume sprays.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to kill the mosquitoes that are flying. And that's typically, depending upon when they're spraying, you might kill about 30-40% of the mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, that's used as an emergency when you've already detected that the mosquitoes are out there have West Nile virus in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not much else you can do. Most what we like to do is hit the mosquitoes early and at the larval stage, the immature stages,
mm-hmm.
and keep the number of mosquitoes down that way. Because the whole thing about risk is the abundance of mosquitoes that have the West Nile virus in them.
So when the populations are smaller, there's a smaller percentage of mosquitoes that will be vectors for that disease.
There's a less chance of it bridging over to the humans.
To humans, okay.
If you keep the populations of mosquitoes down low.
Well, Richard Lantman, let's step back a minute from mosquitoes as carriers of West Nile virus, because I do want to get back to that topic. That preventing that disease is the main thrust of this show here. Talk about mosquito biology. How do mosquitoes fit into the great scheme of things in terms of their place in the cycle of life, the food chain, et cetera, in general?
That's something that a lot of people have asked me before, and I always get stunned at first when they ask me. Because most of them are fairly knowledgeable about food webs and food chains. And when you think about it, mosquitoes, they're small, very abundant organisms in aquatic places.
Mm-hmm.
And so they serve as the basis of the food chain for a lot of other aquatic animals, you know,
mm-hmm.
ranging from other invertebrates to fish, to vertebrates that are in aquatic areas. So mosquitoes can be a substantial part of the food chain. Now, where we come into a problem is when we have larval habitats that aren't natural. So in mm-hmm. other words, when you have containers around your house, swimming pools, gutters, garbage cans, you know, jars.
Right.
Those aren't areas where you're going to have other aquatic insects or fish or whatever.
Right.
And that's when the mosquitoes become a problem. It's because they have no predation whatsoever from the in there. And so they escape from that aspect, and the numbers just bloom. In a natural ecosystem, you're going to have mosquitoes, but they're more or less somewhat controlled by the predators that are that they're feeding upon them. And when we used to rear mosquito fish, mm-hmm. it used to amaze me the number of mosquitoes I had to rear to keep the fish alive. Because every day I was feeding these fish about 150 or so, each fish about 150 mosquito larvae. So I had to produce unbelievable amounts of mosquitoes just to keep, you know, about 25 fish alive.
Hopefully you were doing that in Petri dishes or something.
I had a little aquaria where I'd be dropping them in there. It was always amazing me because I was wondering, when will these fish stop eating these mosquitoes? And that's one of the reasons why when you have some of these areas that have emergent vegetation, as long as you have minnows in that area, you very seldom see much of a problem with the mosquitoes.
Well, Richard Lantman, when you say mosquitoes are a food source for invertebrates, vertebrates, and fish, what kind of invertebrates and vertebrates are you talking about there specifically?
Well, once again, like you said, yeah, fish is one thing.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of the dragonfly, the aquatic stages of the dragonflies and things like that that feed on,
mm-hmm.
on mosquitoes also.
Hmm.
And so there are a fair number of things that feed on them.
In the summer, in a summer food chain, in a sort of a normally balanced environment, what proportion of the diet of living things would you say mosquitoes make up?
On that one, I really can't answer because when they do different studies, you get kind of different answers on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really based upon the area you're in. For mm-hmm. example, one of the things you often hear is they talk about promoting having bats around your yard.
Mm-hmm.
Bats can consume so many adult mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And they'll cite a study where it said they, you know, took bats and they cut them open or whatever, and they found out that there were so many thousand mosquitoes in them.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble was, that was an atypical situation. Normally, you're not going to find a bat sustaining itself entirely on mosquitoes because it just is a little too much work.
Yeah, yeah.
That bat is normally going to be feeding on much larger things.
Huh.
So when you're talking about percentage of being used by different things, it's really kind of variable, and I really don't have a good answer for you on that.
My guest is Richard L. Lantman. He is a medical entomologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, And we're talking about mosquitoes on tonight's edition of Earthworms. And we're talking about that prompted by the fact that we've started mosquito season. It's well underway. And one of the things that mosquitoes can transmit to humans is a disease that you do not want to get, which is West Nile virus. Tell us a little bit about West Nile. How did it originate? What kind of a disease is that? And what's the relationship to mosquitoes, Richard Lampman?
Well, West Nile virus is in a group of viruses called flaviviruses. It's like a Japanese encephalitis virus, St. Louis encephalitis virus. They're all kind of grouped closely together.
Mm-hmm.
And West Nile was all in the old world. And then in 1999, we started having, in New York City, they started having human cases of encephalitis. They also had a lot of crows dying in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the zoo animals were getting sick also. And at first, no one connected these things together at all because we really don't have a mosquito-borne virus here that would affect all those organisms in the way they were being affected.
Mm-hmm.
Then when these different groups started looking at the organisms that were infecting those animals, they found out that they were dealing with the same thing.
Mm.
And that's when they discovered it was an exotic virus, so a virus that had been introduced to the United States for the first time. And because it was introduced to the area where there's no resistance. We've never been exposed to it. Our birds have never been exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
It more or less flourished and bloomed and spread rapidly. And most people that made predictions about West Nile virus, based upon what we knew on St. Louis encephalitis virus, which is really closely related, most of those predictions were wrong. What West Nile virus showed us was, first of all, we didn't know as much as we thought we knew about transmission cycles or about mosquito biology and ecology.
Mm-hmm.
But within 5 years, that mosquito went from coast to coast. I mean, that virus went from coast to coast.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just unbelievable.
I remember when West Nile cases were first being reported in Missouri and noticing the just really major drop, decimation of the population of birds in the corvid family, crows and jays.
Crows are very sensitive. That's one of the things that was so unusual about West Nile, is that crows were very sensitive and horses were very sensitive.
Uh-huh.
And so when West Nile first came in, you saw a lot of horse cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the crows you still see. And the crows are a good sentinel. So as long as you have crows around, if you start to see them, large crows in your urban areas,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a good indication that transmission is probably going on.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble comes in is when you have some of these areas where you have a high level of transmission,
mm-hmm.
the crow population has been so decimated that you don't have a lot of crows to act as sentinels anymore.
Mm.
And so you don't see the visible signs of the virus anymore.
Right.
So that's why you have to have some type of public health group or a mosquito abatement group looking at the mosquitoes and checking them for the presence of virus.
What effect does West Nile virus have on humans?
Well, it's an encephalitic virus.
What does that mean?
Is it basically infects the covering of the brain, okay,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the nerve tissue. And with that, you get a swelling, temperatures, and all kinds of symptoms. And what they found is that they have the one called West Nile virus neuroinvasive disease. Now, okay, that's the one that's very severe and occurs more often in older patients. And that's the one where you can get basically paralytic type, symptoms out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have the one that's called West Nile virus fever.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that you often find more in the younger groups. And it was always considered before to be something like a summer flu.
Mm.
But the more they started following up on the patients that had the West Nile virus fever, the more they found that they had neural sequelae, that is, they had these after effects.
Mm.
So a lot of people that got West Nile fever, supposedly the mild form, they reported back that it would be anywhere from 3 to 6 months before they began to feel anywhere close to what they considered normal again.
Mm.
And a few people would say it would be almost up to a year or more.
Mm-hmm.
So the fever part, which was always thought to be relatively mild, turned out to be a little bit more symptomatic than we had always thought it would be.
Is there a vaccine or a treatment for this disease?
They're working on various types of vaccines for West Nile. One of the problems with vaccines is that most of them also have, you have to look at the the risk with the vaccine and weigh it versus the risk of the virus.
Hmm.
And so there are a lot of people, there are a lot of different groups that are working on different types of the vaccine. And I haven't seen anything yet as far as them coming out to where they're going to start marketing one. It's very similar to, if you remember, Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
Lyme disease was a very big deal because it's the number of cases. I think from 2003 to 2005, there was something like almost 40,000 cases in the United States.
Hmm.
And as you recall, there was a Lyme disease vaccine.
No, I don't remember that.
Well, there was, and a lot of people on the East Coast were using it because they were so frightened by Lyme disease.
Yeah.
It's primarily, we wouldn't know about it here.
Yeah.
Because Lyme disease is primarily one of these ones that's restricted to the wooded areas where you find a lot of deer.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
it's carried by deer
our
ticks,
plains,
right?
Like states, we only see it in some of our corners of our state and things like that.
Yeah.
But on the northeastern part of the United States, that was something that they were fairly well worried about. Well, they had a vaccine for Lyme disease, but apparently it got withdrawn because apparently it wasn't cost effective to make it anymore.
Hmm. Is there now you mentioned that horses get West Nile virus too?
And there's a vaccine for the horses.
Why are horses vaccinated, and can horses be vaccinated and humans cannot? Is there so much of a difference between horse biology and human biology, or is that an FDA testing protocol situation, or what?
No, it's more along the lines of, in a sense, it is the safety of the human versus the safety of the horse. They're willing to accept more risk with the horse than you are with the human.
Hmm.
So, in other words, so the horse vaccine is three different shots. They're spread out through time. And if you do get a bad adverse effect in 1 in 1,000, it's not considered as bad as if you got a 1 in 1,000 effect in humans.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, that's the way it is.
Because
you still would preserve the 1,000 of your horses. Whereas humans, it's, you know, you wouldn't... No, I don't think anyone would accept those odds if you gave them that.
So, Richard Lampman, tell me what the proportion is of people in the population. How prevalent is West Nile virus? How prevalent is our humans? How many, you know, talk about cases that we get. How bad a disease is this? And I know Illinois typically reports more cases at the end of the season than Missouri does, but Missouri, I think, had something like 63 or 64 cases reported, and that's people that get sick enough to go to a hospital, right?
Well, it's definitely underreported because, you know, like I said, the symptoms can be like a summer flu.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people that get this don't ever report it, don't ever go see a doctor, and never get a blood test to see what they had. So it's very underreported. What they do nationally is they look at West Nile neuroinvasive disease, and they have a pretty good, those are things that are reported because it's severe.
Mm-hmm.
They have a pretty good idea that for every one case of that, there's about 140 to 150 cases of just West Nile virus infections.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at it nationwide, they've estimated it's been about 1.5 to 2 million people that have been infected by West Nile virus. And in Illinois, it changes so much from year to year, but we run somewhere in the hundreds of cases every year. And in the United States, we run somewhere in the 5,000 or so cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the neuroinvasive, you could probably take, you know, that and talk about how we're running into the, you know, 250,000 or whatever people being exposed every year.
And you're talking about a disease here. I mean, granted, not everybody that gets bitten by mosquitoes is going to get this disease, and not everybody that gets the disease is going to have serious effects, but you can have brain damage, you can become paralyzed, you can die from this disease from a mosquito.
Right. It's a probability aspect there with the severity of the symptoms.
Yeah.
So the mortality rate, I think, has been changing on this a little bit, but I think it's somewhere around the 3% case fatality rate.
Yeah.
The number of severe cases are normally, like I said to be about 1 to 150.
Mm-hmm.
So you have one severe case for every less than every 100 people that get it.
Right. You just do not want to be that 1 in 100 or 1 in 150.
No. I had someone once flippantly say that wouldn't it just be best if we all went out and got West Nile virus? And I said, well, first of all, I'm 55 years old. And so when you look at those age group things, I'm smack dab right in the peak thing for some of the symptoms. And no, I don't think I'd want to have feeling like I was having arthritis and neuralgia and all kinds of muscle aches for the next, you know, year or so.
Mm-mm.
And the possibility that it could be severe.
Mm-hmm. No, you don't want to risk this. And you know, my purpose in wanting to focus on this topic on tonight's edition of this environmental talk show, Earthworms, on KDHX, is because we are having mosquito season, and you can get a really serious disease from mosquito bites, which are something you get all the time when you go outside, and public education, individual responsibility, homeowner, neighborhood responsibility is where prevention happens the most crucially.
And you're absolutely right. And West Nile virus is one of those, also, it's a very difficult thing to get across, because here's one of the problems. I said that the Culex mosquitoes are the ones that are the major vectors.
Yeah.
Those primarily feed on birds, and they have a small amount of feeding on mammals and humans. So most people, when they go out and they're getting bit in their backyards doing any type of gardening or anything like that, those are not Culex mosquitoes normally.
Hmm.
So normally those are, like we're having now, a lot of what we call the floodwater mosquitoes. And primarily it's probably Aedes vexans, the inland floodwater mosquito, because we've had so much rain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that mosquito is not really transmitting any type of disease to you. But you're walking outside and going, oh my gosh, I'm getting bit, I'm getting bit. Now, that mosquito's population after about 2 to 3 weeks will start to go down. And you'll go out and you'll maybe feel one mosquito versus bite versus before you were getting 30, 40.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's when that time when you get in the lower number of mosquito bites, that's the most dangerous time.
Uh-huh.
Because this Culex is only feeding, like I said, about 10-15% on mammals. So what we try to do is try to tell everybody, listen, don't just think mosquitoes when you're out there all the time getting bit.
Yeah.
Think of mosquitoes all the time.
We're going to have a little information before this topic is, we're done talking about this topic on tonight's edition of Earthworms, about herbal alternatives to commercial chemical insect repellents.
Right.
So that's coming up with Jeff Hoard from Cheryl's Herbs in Maplewood, Missouri. But right now I'm talking with Richard Lantman, who is a medical entomologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. We're talking about mosquitoes, mosquito populations, mosquito control, and the disease that they carry, which is West Nile virus, which you do not want to get. Talk about mosquito biology, Richard Lantman. How do mosquitoes develop? What is the lifespan of a mosquito? When you're looking at keeping standing water off of your property, controlling the breeding conditions, what kinds of time frames are you dealing with there? Does that mean that like you can like never have any ponds in your property, or you shouldn't have bird baths, or how do you deal with that stuff?
Well, first of all, everybody asks questions like there's a simple answer in a sense, but I have to remind people, in Illinois, they were probably dealing with about 60 to 70 mosquito species.
Mm-hmm.
And among that, we probably got about 6 different type of biology, ecology groups. And so the answers for those things kind of vary. But let me concentrate on the ones we're talking about as far as the ones that are potential vectors of West Nile virus. That's the Culex group of mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that mosquito lays its eggs in what we call a raft. In other words, all the eggs are pasted together and it floats on the surface of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that raft hatches typically within 2 days after it's laid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the female mosquito, she picks a place to lay that egg raft by sense of smell, essentially. She likes to find places that have a high amount of organic content to it. So, something swampy smelling. Okay? And what we do when we're doing our mosquito collections, we take grass and put it in water for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that smell, that grass infusion smell, is what attracts mosquitoes to our traps.
Mm.
And that's the same smell she's naturally attracted to when you have some of these areas,
mm-hmm.
ditches or whatever. So she comes in, she smells that. The smell tells her there's food for her offspring. She lays her eggs there. In about 2 days, they hatch. The larvae, the immature stage, is all aquatic. They go through 4 instars, first, second, third, fourth instar.
What's an instar?
An instar is the way insects change in size is they have to molt from one stage to the next. And the different number of molts are often called instars.
Uh-huh.
And so the first instar of a mosquito larva is so small, you can barely see it. Okay. But by the time you get a second instar, it looks like a comma on a page.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it goes through this development, and development is really tied into temperature.
Hmm.
So as you go into the summer, it develops faster.
Hmm.
But typically, from the time it hatches to the time an adult's coming off, can be anywhere between 5 and 14 days, depending upon temperature.
Hmm.
Now, you asked the question about different types of things. Can you have a pond? A pond is generally not a problem. The edge of the pond can be a problem if you have a lot of emergent vegetation.
Hmm.
A pond, generally, if you don't have emergent vegetation, has like a little wave action on it, and that kind of stops the breaks up eggrass and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have emergent vegetation, you have all these little places that they can get sequestered and hidden and stay away from that.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, with the Culex, we're talking about man-made containers
mm-hmm.
holding water and catch basins in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
All the cities, when you have the stormwater systems, they tend to have these areas where you catch debris coming off the street.
Yeah.
And that's so it doesn't go into the main line and clog it up.
Yeah.
Those catch basins are catching organic debris, like people put grass clippings out in the street. Then they get water in there. And then what you're doing is you're making the same thing I make to attract mosquitoes. And so the mosquitoes come into the catch basins, they start laying their eggs and start producing adults.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about, I don't want to say nice thing, the fascinating thing about this Culex pipiens, it's a very urban mosquito, it's very well associated with humans. And so it looks for things around the house, and so that's where you get your exposure from, is the mm-hmm. fact that it's around your area. And there are times, it's called the house mosquito because it used to always come into the houses, you know, before we had screens and everything, air conditioning and things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
We used to always drag that mosquito in with us. And then when there were no birds around, it would obviously then feed on the humans in the house or whatever.
Richard Lentman, I made an assumption that mosquitoes breed in standing water or stagnant water. Is that correct?
Those are the Culex. They tend to
uh-huh.
like that.
Uh-huh.
And then there are some anopheles that tend to like that.
Uh-huh.
Most of the time when you have flowing water, you're right, you don't have a mosquito problem there.
Tell me if I'm right about this. Culex pipiens, is it a very, very tiny little mosquito that's kind of like black and blue striped?
No.
Oh.
We call it the little brown mosquito.
Hmm.
And so some people think it's not very good looking as far as mosquitoes go, but it's got some qualities to it. Some of the scaling on it there are pretty nice. So what you're talking about, it sounds like a different species entirely. If you're talking about a small mosquito that has like little metallic flakes on it, bluish metallic flakes.
I haven't looked at it quite that closely, but they are definitely have little blue and black stripes along their body.
Are they very small?
Very small, and no specific feeding period. Like, you know, you often hear, don't go out at dusk and dawn, that's when mosquitoes are feeding. These are out feeding all the time, these little blue and black striped ones.
Well, there is a mosquito. There's a greenish-type mosquito that has little bluish-type metallic flakes on it.
Mm.
And that's Uranotania is the genus, and Saffarina is the species that we have around here. It tends to feed on frogs, reptiles, and amphibians.
Mm.
And that's the one I'm thinking of there.
Hmm.
There are some more exotic ones. I don't know about the blue, though. That's hmm. a little different for me. I mean, obviously hmm. the 80s Albopictus has a lot of stripes on it. The Japonicus, the new invasive species, also tends to have a lot of stripes in the legs and stuff like that. But it doesn't ring a bell to have this blue and stripes on it.
Uh-huh.
The best thing in the world, I tell you, is always send us a specimen.
Uh-huh.
That's what we do. if you have a question about the mosquito, if you can collect one, send it to us and we'll identify it.
And that's the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. Richard Lentman, so eliminating standing water from your property, keeping your gutters clean, keeping those little puddles that collect in the upturned, you know, the upturned edges of your muck buckets, little places where standing water tends to pool and collect, it's important to pay attention to those and eliminate that standing water, right?
Right, and it's always, especially for the Culex, that's what they really like, is some something that's got some type of organic material in it.
Yeah.
And it's always easy to overlook something. I went around the other day. I was trying to get rid of some of the containers around our house. Actually, my wife was telling me that I should do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at them to see what larvae were in them. And then suddenly I looked at one of the flower pots and the little bottom plate under it.
Mm.
I noticed there were larvae in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, you know, I never would have even thought, because it's such a thin amount of water there. I wouldn't have thought really that particular one would have had any, but
yeah.
Sure enough it did.
They look like little wiggling kind of, you know, just little white little wiggling things, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And they have a stage that's called a pupal stage that looks like a comma that actually swims around.
What about, people have asked me about bushes, spraying your yard. What about that kind of aspect of mosquito control? True or false? Work or not?
It's a space spray, and it has a temporary action. And if you often they'll use that if you're having, let's say, a party in the backyard. And so you'll use a space spray. It'll give you a knockdown, and you'll have, you know, maybe an hour, 2 hours of relative freedom.
Of adult, but, from adult
right,
mosquitoes.
Adults.
Yeah,
but you're not going to have anything of any long lasting. The adults do rest during the day. One thing that kills mosquitoes the fastest is low humidity.
Oh,
so they can't be out in the sunlight.
Mm.
So they have to find areas around vegetation that has high humidity and shade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things when you do a barrier spray. Sometimes you're trying also to kill the mosquitoes. They're landing there to rest during the day.
Yeah.
But by and far, it's not very effective because you have a large reservoir of mosquitoes in your neighborhood area.
Yeah. Huh. What about larvicides?
Larvicides are typically what we try to go with first. We try to knock the population down by hitting the immature stages. And the reason that is so appealing to us is because the adults can fly all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And when they fly, it can be based upon temperature, can be based upon the wind speed of the
mm-hmm.
day. Larvae are restricted to an aquatic habitat. If you find that aquatic habitat, that stagnant water site, you can treat it and you can kill the larvae and
mm-hmm.
you can prevent them from having any adults come off of it. So that's why the larvicides are so appealing, is they prevent the adults, and plus they're constant. The larvae are concentrated there, and you don't have to worry about this great mobility that the adult has.
We are going to talk, as I said a few moments ago, we're going to talk about non-toxic options for human insect repellent sprays. But Richard Lantman, tell me about larvicide. What kind of substances are they? Can you get substances that are biological as opposed to chemical? Are they toxic to humans, pets? What's the pros and cons of larvicide?
Most of the ones we use nowadays are microbial, that is the Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. It's
mm-hmm.
pretty specific toward flies, mosquitoes, and chironomids.
Mm-hmm.
And also there are some that they sell, what they call these little donuts that you can put in places and bird baths and things that have insect growth regulators in them.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be like Altacid, methoprene. It has a methoprene in it. It's a juvenile hormone analog, so it stops the adult from emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So most of those are very specific toward the target. They have a little activity towards some other insects, but besides that, they're very specific.
Hmm.
The chemical insecticides, there are a few that are pretty good, but there's one called Temifos that can be used and even used in drinking water.
Hmm.
But the Bacillus is the one that's probably the mainstay, followed by this methoprene, the Altacid, type briquettes, the juvenile hormone
mm-hmm.
analogs.
So like if you have a rain barrel or something, it's good to keep larvicide in your rain barrel because...
Well, that's one of the little things for the donuts, for the Altacid, is that they make those that you just drop part of that in there and it's good for, you know, 2-3 months.
Yeah, those are called mosquito dunks, I think,
right.
commonly. So you, in your work with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, Richard Lantman, as a medical entomologist, what is... tell us something that is really particularly challenging to you in the way this disease is being managed, in the way public education is being managed, and also are there any success points happening right now in this part of the Midwest?
Oh, I think there's a lot of success on that. What's fascinating to me is the interaction of the mosquito with the birds and how you get this transmission cycle going.
Mm-hmm.
The way we were always taught when I was coming up was that there are so many different variables associated with transmission. The transmission was typically very unlikely. With West Nile virus, it certainly isn't that way.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly seems to be able to overcome lots of different variables and still being able to transmit. So to me, that's fascinating.
My understanding is
find out exactly what are the factors involved in that.
And yeah,
it's been great.
My understanding is a mosquito bites an infected bird. The mosquito transmits that virus, is the vector for that virus, and bites either another infected bird or a horse or a human, and then transmits the virus to the next susceptible individual. You cannot get transmission directly between, say, humans and humans.
Well, that's one of the things that we've learned. You can get transmission from human to human, but it's rare, extremely rare, and it's typically when you're talking about transfusions, transplants,
mm-hmm.
things like that. That's why one of the things they do now is they screen the blood supply.
Mm-hmm.
They had a large number of people that were donating blood that were viremic for West Nile virus, didn't really have any symptoms, whatever, they're asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the donors would end up getting the West Nile virus.
Mm-hmm.
And typically the donors getting the blood, the ones that are on the immune, you know, compromised immune system, because they're undergoing some type of surgery or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of the things that no one had thought of, and so that's generally rare.
Yeah.
The major transmission is from the mosquito, as you said. Mosquito takes the blood meal. Let's say it's uninfected. It finds a bird that has the virus circulating through its blood. That virus is at a level that will infect the mosquito, maybe for about 3 days maximum. Okay, so that mosquito takes the blood meal, and that virus now has to replicate in the mosquito. It has to cross the gut wall. It has to then go through the circulatory system, the open blood system of the mosquito. It has to cross the membranes of the salivary glands,
mm-hmm.
and it has to infect the salivary glands. Every time a mosquito takes a blood meal, it injects saliva in at the same time. The way you get the virus is that when it salivates, and it also releases the virus at the same time because the salivary glands are infected. Once the salivary glands are infected, that mosquito can now infect another animal. If it did, like you said, bit another viremic bird, that's not really adding to the cycle any. If it bites a susceptible bird that is free of virus, that's going to add to the cycle. And so that's how what happens is that when you first start off, the probability of finding a bird that hasn't got the virus in it after your first bite,
mm-hmm.
is very high. And so that starts to go downhill as you get the season going on.
Yeah.
And that's one of the factors that controls the end of the season.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your talking to us tonight. It's important, I think, that people in our part of the country understand what West Nile virus is, how you can get it, how important it is that we all maintain a good watch on our property, keep gutters clean, keep saucers under plants dumped out, put larvicide in rain barrels, rinse out your bird bath every so often, and just do not create mosquito breeding habitats. One last question for you, Rich Lantman. If you feel like there's a lot of mosquitoes in your area, is it a reasonable thing to do to, say, call your city vector control and ask them to put larvicide in the sewers? In the catch basins of the sewers?
If that's just, if your city has that, then that's normally what they would do.
Uh-huh.
That's what we do in the Champaign-Urbana area.
Mm-hmm.
Is that's our primary thing is to treat catch basins and then do scouting.
Mm-hmm.
Where we look for above ground sites that we can treat.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the cities I know of that have some type of vector control program, that's basically what they also do.
Mm-hmm.
They try to keep the catch basins relatively free. You can also, there are certain times when you have heavy rainfalls, they're going to be flushed also. So, But basically right now, I don't think anyone's hoping for any heavy rainfalls.
I don't know. It's been dry here for a couple of days.
Yeah,
we could use a little spritz here in St. Louis.
Have you crested? Has your river crested?
Yes, but I don't live near it, so
okay.
No. Actually, the Mississippi still the crest is still coming in the Mississippi. Yeah, I don't mean to be flippant about that because there are folks who really are in some pretty severe
storms. One of the problems is when you have heavy flooding and breaking of levees and things like that. One of the things we always have to worry about is that after the flooding, mm-hmm. the water starts to recede.
Mm-hmm.
Then you form these habitats, like I told you, the polluted water ones,
mm-hmm.
the stagnant area,
mm-hmm.
and those are perfect for Culex mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so after flooding like this, we always have to worry about 2 to 3 weeks after the flooding, are we going to have a sudden increase in Culex mosquitoes?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very likely that the state and also people from our laboratory are going to be going out to various areas in the western part of Illinois just to see if the numbers of Culex are exploding and whether or not the virus is there or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for talking to us tonight, Rich Lantman.
Thank you for
the work that you do, and really appreciate this update on mosquitoes and ways to prevent mosquito-borne diseases.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Dr. Richard Lantman, he is a medical entomologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, and on the line with us now as we continue this conversation about mosquitoes, preventing mosquito bites, preventing mosquito-borne diseases, specifically West Nile virus, a disease you do not want to get, is Jeff Hoard of Cheryl's Herbs in Maplewood, Missouri. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. Well, you know, I'm a lot better since I discovered that there are some herbal alternatives as mosquito repellents, alternatives to products containing DEET, which all the standard literature tells you should wear repellents containing DEET.
I'm sorry, Gene, I had some interference there, and I just...
Natural herb-based as opposed to chemical-based insect repellents.
I think I'm hearing some the leftover from Dr. Lapman's line, and I can't...
There you go. I know. Okay. Okay.
So we're talking herbal alternatives, right?
Right, right. Yeah. First of all, what is DEET?
Well, you should have asked Dr. Lantman about that. I could listen to him for the whole time. He was fascinating. DEET is, most of the commercial brands of insect repellent contain DEET. It's a chemical that is used. The reason that we look at alternatives is because, you know, DEET has potential toxic effects.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the instructions, especially using it with children and mm-hmm. things, they're very, you can't even get it on you. And so, and plus, you know, we're not, where we come from as herbalists is not really wanting to use that kind of product.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, herbal insect and repellents have been around for centuries, and a lot of different plants have been used and, over the years, and some of them, you know, work fairly well, some of them not so well. Some of the products don't work so well. The citronella oil might work well if you had something to put on your skin or your clothes. But in candles, I don't know if that really works so well.
I was excited, Jeff Hoard, to find online the report of a study from the University of Iowa citing that catnip oil has something like 10 times more mosquito repellent capability than DEET.
That's right. According to the way they did it, that it showed that, and at a very small percentage dilution of the catnip oil, you know, around 1% or even down to 0.1%. And there's also another study that's done in 2005. It was reported in the Journal of Medical Entomology. And USDA has a page on this study. And they actually, it shows maybe not so much as 10 times, probably using different techniques. But... they recommend it as the USDA recommends it as a alternative to reduce our dependence upon synthetic repellents.
Mm-hmm.
So that I found that encouraging too. That still, you know, what they found in 2001 still seems true. And actually, they reported that that the catnip oil had a better effect as a spatial repellent, and that DEET was actually a little more effective as a contact repellent. But I think, you know, if you can keep them away from you, they're not going to contact you, you know. You don't need to. And I've noticed that with, not with mosquitoes, but I've noticed it with in the garden with just all flying insects, bees and whatever, that when I'm covered with the catnip, it's like I got this bubble around me. And when I move back from an area that the bees have been working in, they'll go back in the area, but they just don't want to be around me. So,
what does catnip smell like?
Catnip doesn't really smell really great. That's one of the problems with it. And the product that we make, we mix it with peppermint essential oil, and it's in peppermint hydrosol, which is just water that's left over from the distillation of peppermint oil. And so it's real nice. You put it on your skin. It's not oily or anything. And the peppermint is great in the summer because it cools you off when you put it on your skin. And I like that a lot. And makes it smell a little better, the peppermint. And peppermint has its own mosquito repelling properties. Not like the catnip, but, you know. Plants are a good way. Peppermint plants, catnip plants, tansy plants in your garden. That they really help to keep them away. They don't like them.
As an option, instead of spraying stuff around your bushes, plant those plants.
Yeah, something else to do. Keep them. They generally will go somewhere else. And why exactly, we don't know yet. What it is that, you know, about the oil that repels the mosquitoes. They do in plants, essential oils. That's one of their functions. Is to repel insects from the plant itself. And sometimes the essential oils are used to attract, you know, pollinators and things.
Well, Jeff Hoard, I've tried, we got at work, we got some samples of the summer spray, which is available at Cheryl's Herbs in Maplewood. That's one of the products that you have that has catnip oil, I think, in peppermint oil.
That's
and
the one.
Got another one from Herbal Remedies that has catnip oil, and it's a little bit more menthol-y, not so minty. And having tried these now, cutting the grass, trimming hedges, and walking around on a gravel bar by the Merrimack River, one mosquito has landed on me.
Oh, that's not bad.
In those time frames. No, and you know, I'm not real prone to being bitten, but frankly, I don't want to be bitten by anything.
Have you met any new cats in your neighborhood?
No. No. And that's,
that will happen.
I bet it will. Yeah, I'll bet you'll be really a source of entertainment. Well, I'm going to get on to another topic here tonight, Jeff, but thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us. And where is Cheryl's Herbs?
Cheryl's Herbs is at 7159 Manchester Road in Maplewood. And all of our products and tons of information are available on our website, cherylsherbs.com.
In fact, I think there is an article about catnip oil as a natural mosquito repellent.
Yeah, it's a good article. It goes through all in detail about all the study and everything.
Good. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks
for
talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your work.
Okay.
Jeff Hoard of Cheryl's Herbs in Maplewood, Missouri. And I've got a couple of minutes left here tonight on this edition of Earthworms, the Environmental Information Show on KDHX St. Louis Community Radio. I'm Gene Ponzi, here with you every Tuesday night from 7 to 8 p.m., followed by, at 8 o'clock, Stumble in the Dark with James, Jazz, and Jam Band's fabulous musical entertainment from 8.